Welcome back to Highly Respected. I'm your host, Scott Greer. Today, I'm joined by Vincent James. Vince is the man behind the popular Red Elephants YouTube channel and website. Vince, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, Vince, I thought you would be the best person to discuss the subject today. Last week, a horrific video emerged of a young black man beating an elderly veteran, white veteran, by the way, in a Michigan nursing home. Vince, can you explain what's the backstory here?
Yeah, so this guy, Jaden Hayden, which, by the way, the media is really not covering this story, and we all know why, because it's not a white attacker, and they can't use this for their race-hustling narrative, unfortunately. But yeah, there was a man who recorded himself beating this elderly white man in a nursing home. Several different individuals, actually. There are a couple of videos that have come out. And since then, he has been arrested only because of social media, because this person actually recorded this beating himself, and someone found it, I believe, on Snapchat or some social media platform of his and exposed it. It went viral, and the Detroit police released a statement quite recently saying that they have arrested this individual and his bond is marked at $300,000. Now, of course, if this was in the reverse, we would be hearing about the DOJ and the media recommending hate crime charges. But that's not happening here. Now, the problem is that the thing that I don't think a lot of people are focusing on is that this is a frequent occurrence in nursing homes. Now, this guy doesn't really completely fit the profile of nursing care worker abusing elderly patients.
Yeah, because he's not a nursing care worker. No. He was, if I'm not mistaken, he was placed there under the suspicion that he had coronavirus, which seems quite odd that the policy in Michigan is to send young people who are suspected of coronavirus to the most vulnerable population in the entire country, to with elderly people who are in many cases not well. And even any person over 65 is at risk, but especially these people in a nursing home.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, that whole thing just came out recently. Like, I didn't know about this when this first broke. But I mean, still, I mean, we could really tie this into sort of I don't know if I want to say epidemic, but it certainly is a frequent occurrence of black care workers abusing white elderly patients far more than the reverse of this. Now, like I said, I mean, if this was a white individual who was placed in a nursing care facility with the majority of black patients and started punching them and abusing them on camera, I mean, we would be having congressional hearings about white racism and white supremacy nonstop for the next 6 months, probably. But see, it didn't fit the exact media narrative that they wanted. So, you know, it was very rarely covered. I mean, you can't even find, when you Google search Jaden Hayden, you Google search the name of the attacker, I mean, you get a few fleeting articles here and there, many of which don't even mention race. Now, we know that it would be completely obvious to the reader it was in the reverse. And so this is
just one of the many examples
of the media narrative being completely exposed by the lack of coverage of certain occurrences.
Yeah, and the only way that this really got a lot of attention is, I believe, Trump watched it on Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson, of course, covered this, I believe, Thursday or Friday night. And Trump tweeted out, like, can this be real? Or how is this real? Like, how is this happening? Like, is anyone checked on the victim? And he was like tweeting this out, and it's like very not obvious that what was he talking about? I mean, people in the replies were having to say, like, yes, this is a nursing home beating. Of course, me, Trump reply guy, retired Trump reply guy. We'll get on that later in the show. But it's like the president of the United States is tweeting out about this, and liberals' reaction towards it was not that, wow, it's a horrifying video, like, why wouldn't the president talk about this? They're like, this is disgusting act of anti-black racism for the president to even notice this. And it's like, and Trump, of course, didn't mention the race. He didn't mention even the race of the victim. He didn't mention any of that. I mean, he was just simply saying, like, this is an awful video. Like, have they caught the guy? Is the victim okay? And this is like a pretty normal reaction to any person reacting to this video, regardless of race, regardless of political affiliation. But they immediately said, like, he's race baiting. He didn't even tweet out the video. He just simply said, like, I hope this guy is okay, and I hope they get the perp. And the liberals are like saying, like, This crime isn't that big of a deal. It's okay to beat up old people in a nursing home, defenseless right. old people when you're a 20-year-old boxer. It's okay to keep punching them. The real problem is noticing it. And they did this a lot with the Ahmaud Arbery case when people would bring up other instances of black-on-white violence, like such as the man who sniped at an elderly couple in a Delaware, I believe it was a Delaware cemetery.
Yeah, Delaware, right.
A Delaware cemetery, or, you know, there was a murder in Indianapolis where a guy just gunned down a mail carrier for no reason at all. And I believe there was something else in Oklahoma similar along these lines. But if you even brought this up, you were considered a racist. But, you know, bringing up one murder in Georgia, white on black violence that happened there, this is like the biggest news story in the world, and this is what you should talk about. And there were several people who were attacking Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk was surprisingly being pretty much better on Ahmaud Arbery than everybody else. He didn't really talk about it, but he was talking about the sniper situation in Delaware and the continuing violence going on in Chicago. And he was just like simply saying this stuff, and they're like, hey, racist, why aren't you talking about Arbery? So it's just, once again, right. this stuff is just so common that you're just supposed to shrug and say, this is part and parcel of living in multicultural America, that you're going to be an old person, you're going to be 80 years old, you're going to be a veteran, you're, you know, nearing the end of your life, and you're going to have to deal with some guy punching you as you're trying to sleep, or and you're in a very seriously ill condition. This is just something you have to deal with, and it's not, you know, that's too bad. We're just going to shrug our shoulders. Right. But the real tragedy
explained away is like an economic issue, right?
Yeah. Or the real tragedy is if the president of the United States worries about it, or if a jogger in Georgia, a alleged jogger in Georgia, is gunned down. You know, those are the right. real like crimes against humanity. But the ongoing normal violence of just like a black guy randomly murdering a white person, or a black care worker, or a suspected black coronavirus patient abusing elderly is just something we have to shrug off and not notice.
Right. And the thing is that, like I said, a lot of these issues, whenever they are pointed out, is that they're explained away as, quote, economic issues. But that's far from the truth. I mean, Larry Elder has been talking about this extensively on his Twitter account, like this black care worker and Ahmaud Arbery, things like this, pointing out the fact that, you know, when we talk about interracial violent crime, specifically between blacks and whites, black Americans commit 90% of the interracial violent crime. I mean, 90% of it is black on white. And then we look at like the care workers. I mean, I posted a compilation video on my Telegram channel not too long ago of, I don't know, 10, 11 different instances of black care workers just abusing elderly patients. You almost never see this in the reverse. You'll be hard pressed to find a video of a white care worker attacking a black elderly patient in a nursing home. But yet in the reverse, it's far too common. And like you said, whenever you talk about it, then you're labeled as a racist, you're labeled as race baiting. And then they explain it away as like, oh, this is a result of economic issues or socioeconomic issues in the black and brown community. When, I mean, you look at this.
Or this is just an individual problem. This is just one bad apple.
Right. Just one thing, one fleeting occurrence that has no connection whatsoever to the majority of the attacks. But that's not true. I mean, we see hundreds of viral videos of just teen mobs attacking random white individuals, not stealing anything from them, just literally just beating them up for no reason. And you want to tell me that that's because of poverty? You want to tell me that we're seeing all these different videos of black care workers attacking white elderly patients because of poverty? You want to tell me that that you know it's because of a socioeconomic status, when I can look at the statistics and I can see that most third world cities, specifically in South and Central America, are statistically safer than most of the majorly black areas in this country, despite having way worse poverty and way worse education? I mean, it's like, come on, why are we lying here? What, you know, it's like I said on Michelle's show today, it's either never mentioned race in any of the headlines like before, or tell the truth. Give us the full context, because right now, like that Delaware shooting was probably a result of the coverage of Ahmaud Arbery, the very dishonest coverage of the Ahmaud Arbery situation.
Yeah, no, and there's always these cases of that, a lot of the violence that happens in a lot of these race hoaxes that get popularized tend to result in reprisal killings and stuff. There was in 2014, when there was all this controversy over police-involved shootings, such as in Ferguson and everything like that, there was two police officers who were murdered in an act of retribution for the black men supposedly killed in cold blood by police officers. And there was the 2016 shooting in Dallas where a black nationalist assassinated five police officers there. And so there's always these cases that we see of that the media hype something up. And then when somebody decides that those, like, there's an epidemic of white police officers murdering blacks without repercussion, without consequence, they decide, well, I'm going to seek retribution for this. I'm going to take action about it. And that could have been very well the case in the Delaware sniping, but we will never hear that. It doesn't matter. We'll have to wait till the court hearing. And even then we might not even hear about it. It'll just only be a few people on Twitter who will notice that. It won't be national news that this guy did this in retribution for Ahmaud Arbery. And, you know, going back to the nursing home situation, you know, I was looking up his statistics, and it shows that about 50% of people who work in home care and nursing care are non-white. And that's disproportionate to the rest of the population. And it's likely more. And also at the same time, there's almost nearly 3 million immigrants who are working in the healthcare industry, many of them who are working in the home care and nursing home profession. Do you think this problem is going to get worse as more immigrants take over these jobs, and as they're taking care of the aging white boomer population?
Yeah, I think, yes, definitely, especially because what we're seeing in academia, sort of the narrative in academia, the narrative coming out of Hollywood, the narrative coming out of most of the media, I think that we're only going to see this get worse. And then these ideas spreading a lot quicker, this sort of narrative spreading a lot quicker because of viral tweets, which seem to be algorithmically boosted by Twitter. It always seems to be the case that, you know, these just statistically incorrect statements on Twitter about, like, white racism always seem to get like 200,000 to 500,000 retweets, whereas like the correction on the tweet or the correction on the story or someone who is tweeting something, the truth about this sort of narrative never seems to get that sort of attention on Twitter. It could just be because Twitter is just heavily populated with liberals, honestly. But I think that it will get worse, because the country is only going to get more diverse as the years pass on. We can look at the birth rates, we can look at the immigration rates, and we can see that this is going to be the case. And I think that with a lot of these people who are taking over these positions of power, especially like district attorneys, we're seeing this happen in San Francisco, we're seeing this happen in Oregon, Portland specifically, who are dropping the charges of people who attempt to kill police or people who attack white people, really specifically black attackers and black criminals, because they want prison reform, criminal justice reform, things like this. They want to, quote, abolish prisons, which is like the new movement. Of course, I think that this is only going to get worse. And it seems like whenever we sort of tell the truth about situations like these, statistics of interracial crime, things like this, you get either kicked off of the social media platform that you're on, or you're labeled a racist and shoved aside. It's just, and you know, the thing is that, like I said on Michelle's show today, if we had conservative ink on our side, we would be able to combat this narrative more effectively, but they're just not on our side for most of the time. Most of the time they sort of inch to the left when certain stories like this pop up. Covington Catholic is a good example.
And another great example is, of course, Ahmaud Arbery, which we'll switch over gears and talk about that, because it's very pertinent to what we were talking about before. Last week, it was announced the state is now prosecuting the guy who filmed Arbery's fatal encounter with the McMichaels. And he's being charged with murder, which sounds a little bit weird that somebody who did not pull the trigger and didn't seem to be involved in the altercation, was just filming it from his truck, is now being charged with murder. That man is William Bryan, and the premise for him being charged with murder was that he was part of the pursuit that led to Arbery's death. And apparently in Georgia law, you can be charged with murder. And there's a couple states where you cannot even be involved in pulling the trigger or the actual assault, but you can be charged with murder. This charge was demanded by Arbery's family and their lawyers, which sounds a little weird, but don't you think the prosecutor is overplaying her hand by charging this guy with murder?
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense to me, honestly. I mean, this guy filmed the occurrence, right? He couldn't go to his house. I mean, his wife even talked about how once the video was released, which, by the way, the video was released by the lawyer who was supposed to be set up to represent the McMichaels, which is honestly strange to me. I guess he thought that this video would exonerate them. Not exactly sure. He decided not to represent them after this video went viral and everyone freaked out about it. But he recorded the occurrence. This video, it led to the arrest of the McMichaels, and this guy is demanded to be charged with murder by the Arbery family. Not only that, but his wife said, and I think it was on a news report, his wife said that they couldn't even go back to their house because of these like Black Panther types patrolling the neighborhood, making sure that no one goes into this guy, you know, like threatening these people, threatening the people of the town. I mean, this is just honest. This is all a result of the media coverage on this, right? This is completely, it's like you said, with the 2015 Black nationalist attacks, the 2016 Baton Rouge attacks by Black nationalists. You know, these are results of the media's coverage. I think Sheriff Clark even went up against Don Lemon on their coverage and withholding full context of sort of the Black Lives Matter situation back in 2015. Same thing with this situation here. So it just doesn't make any sense to me why this guy would be charged. I don't know if it's going to hold up, but it just doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Yeah, and there's a Black prosecutors here. I mean, of course, as everyone knows, the two previous DAs decided to recuse themselves. Well, for one, they thought that the McMichaels were innocent. Second off, they had connections to the elder McMichael. I believe that's, I think if Travis or Greg is the older one, the father, the elder McMichael, and they decided to recuse themselves from this case. And now they found a Black prosecutor from, I believe, Cobb County, which is quite a distance away from where this occurred in Georgia. And they brought her in, and she's like, of course, going gung-ho about this case. And it really appears she's taking marching orders from the chief family lawyer, which is Esley Merritt, who anytime there's like a civil rights flare-up or a race situation, he's always in the mix. There's always these like so-called civil rights lawyers who are always coming down and getting involved in these cases. Right. And of course, he's making a name for himself. He's looking like the great civil rights defender. And he is just intimidating local officials to do his bidding, and they seem to be acquiescing. And this happened the same in the Trayvon Martin case, which last weekend I just watched a great documentary about it, the Trayvon hoax, which was made by Joel Gilbert. I'm pretty sure you've seen it, and I recommend all my listeners watch it. Rather, I was about to say listen, but you can actually watch it, this unlike my podcast. And so I recommend it. It gives you a thorough examination of the case, and it shows that the Trayvon Martin family lawyer, which was Benjamin Crump, I believe that was his name, basically invented a witness or came up with a fake witness, that there was this witness who the film pretty definitively proves that there was this Trayvon had this aunt or girlfriend or fling that he was texting with the night he was shot, and he called her Diamond. And they spent several weeks trying to find her. And then Benjamin Crump at some point is like, oh, I found her. And it's this morbidly obese woman who's like a year older than Trayvon. She didn't really seem to know Trayvon at all. And Trayvon, as shown throughout the film, was like texting like all these like thin Black girls that were his age. And he was like, apparently he was kind of a player, as people would say. And it pretty much shows that like this is definitely not Diamond. This is definitely not Trayvon's girlfriend. And so much of the prosecution hinged on this witness saying that like Trayvon was doing nothing wrong and she was like worried about him. And the defense, or rather not the defense, but the family lawyer, basically found this person because the real Diamond wasn't going to play ball to the extent or would ruin the case. And so they found a patsy who would serve as her for the prosecution. And the prosecution just let it happen. They didn't do any independent verification. They just trusted the family lawyers to such an extent that they let them run the prosecution and proffer up a fake witness who was clearly not the person that Trayvon was talking to. And this person like lied on the witness stand and stuff. And there's been no trial. There's been no charges for anybody involved. And you could very well see this because these prosecutors, well, Trayvon was multiple. This one, it's just one. It's a very ambitious black prosecutor, is the first black prosecutor in Cobb County, clearly has ambitions for higher office and definitely wants to see this as her big break into stardom. We've seen this several times with, if anybody can recall, in Baltimore, you had Marilyn Mosby during the Freddie Gray controversy, and she basically ruined this case by charging all these officers with his death, and she just was so bad about it that it all got thrown out. It all blew up in her face, but she did that in order to gin up her own political ambitions. And there's all these media outlets who are celebrating. They're like, this is my queen. I love Marilyn Mosby. She's taking the heat. We love it. And of course, she just riled up the base and like she calmed down the riots in a certain extent by charging these guys. But the whole case was a disaster, was total chaos. And we could very well see this happen again in the Arbery case.
So, which could take a year. Yeah. I mean, or even more than that. I mean, who knows how long this is actually going to take? Here's the thing. It's like the whole thing hinges on if the pursuit and citizen arrest is deemed legal. Because if it is, if the legality of the pursuit and citizen's arrest is legitimate, then everything gets thrown out. Because then he charges the guy with the gun, tries to take the gun away from him. This is aggravated assault, right? Or assault, and felony assault, certainly. And then he has a right under Georgia law to defend himself. People are pointing out the fact that, it kind of looks like from the video that he pointed his gun before he actually got into a physical altercation with Arbery. That doesn't matter in a citizen's arrest. I mean, we have so many different videos of citizen's arrest, a lot of which are black people arresting white Americans. One in particular went viral. This guy tried to opened up the car door of his car and he held him at gunpoint until the police came. Now, imagine if that white guy got up and started charging the black guy and trying to take his gun away, the guy would have shot him and no one would have ever mentioned it, right? So it doesn't matter if they pointed the gun at Arbery before they got into a physical altercation. The fact is that was the citizen's arrest legal? And it seems like they do sort of have a case for the legality of the citizen's arrest and the pursuit, even though it wasn't a felony that Arbery committed because of the sort of unrest of the town, according to many neighbors, because they've had like tools stolen out of the back of some guy's truck, copper piping we're hearing out of someone else, some other construction site, not this construction site. So that it all hinges on that. And we're probably going to see them call for the heads of these guys. We're seeing the DOJ certainly do that, trying to talk about like some sort of hate crime, even though there's no proof or evidence of racial motivation of this whatsoever. But we're going to have to see how this plays out. It could take a year, could take over a year. But you're exactly right. It's sort of like the Trayvon situation.
Yeah, and it's all due to media intimidation and activist intimidation. I mean, the officials had seen this video many times before, and they and one of the DAs said, it exonerates the McMichael.
Yeah.
So they were saying this. And it was just the fact that the media perception of it was so bad that they're like, this is a modern day lynching. They're like, we gotta do something because otherwise we're gonna look bad. So we gotta charge these guys. And then same thing happened with the Trayvon Martin case. Because the police officers interviewed George Zimmerman. They saw all his injuries, they saw the wounds to his back of his head, they saw the broken nose, they interviewed neighbors who were saying like, we saw Trayvon on top of it and like wailing on him.
Right.
And they all had like a pretty good solid case for self-defense before, but then the media got a hold of it and they spread all these lies that like George Zimmerman like was like preying on him and like Trayvon was trying to run away and he shot him in the back. Like Trayvon being shot in the back was so common during 2012 and it's still common. Like people will probably still say that. We do have politicians who will say Trayvon was murdered in cold blood. They'll ignore the fact that he was like slamming George Zimmerman's head to the ground. And he was like he was 17. He was essentially a grown man and they portrayed him as a boy. They got all these pictures showing him when he was at 12 years old. And they're doing the same with Arbery. They're finding the photo of his graduation photo of him in a tux. They're finding another photo of him in like a polo and a polo hat. And he's got a big smile on. He looks like no threat. They're not showing the police videos of his prior encounters with law enforcement where he's threatening police for just asking him polite questions when he's like looking suspicious in a park or being suspected of stealing a TV. You know, he's clearly demonstrates a very aggressive demeanor who is willing to throw down in under any circumstance. I mean, in one of the videos, I talked about this last week in my podcast that, you know, he's out in the park saying he's just rapping in his car. And this police officer's like, okay, well, I got a few questions. And he's threatening to beat up the police officer for just asking him questions. Yep. And it's like, you know, any sane person is like, look, if the police officer is just asking you questions, don't escalate the situation. Especially don't try threaten to beat him up. And the officer is very friendly. They don't even arrest him for threatening a law enforcement officer. And so that whole video dispelled notions that like police racism is such a problem when the police show incredible restraint. I mean, they were saying they're like, oh, they tried to tase him. And it's like, Arbery kept reaching in his pockets and disobeying law enforcement and showing an aggressive attitude. I mean, it was kind of warranted there. I mean, you could see the
did the arrest video of the Walmart arrest video. Remember that one? The TV. And then other videos. I mean, this guy clearly, and then you have the security footage from outside of him walking through the neighborhood, just sort of strolling and then running inside the house. Like people,
there's all these clips of that. And the family is trying to say, well, they're trying to say that's not him when it's clearly like him in the earlier videos. They're not being, they're not talking about the video from the day because they clearly know it's him.
Yeah.
But they're trying to say like, oh, he's just going in to get water. It's like late at night from his jogging.
He's going to the water station. Like, what? Yeah, I saw that. It was like the media saying he's going to the water. Yeah, it's like what you're talking about. It's like the white racism, black cops or white cops, black people. It's just so bogus. Like anyone who even just takes a quick look at cop killings by race will find that 2 to 3 times more white people are killed by cops on an annual basis. And any proportional overrepresentation of police shootings on black people can be solely attributed to the fact that black Americans commit a homicide rate that is 10 times higher than white Americans, robbery rate that is 20 times higher, rape rate that is 3 times higher, assault rate that is like 6 times higher or 9 times higher, according to all of the data that we have on this. And so they have police run-ins that so despite having police run-ins that it's probably 10 to 20 times more than white Americans are still killed 2 to 3 times more every single year than black Americans by police. And you see, if the media were to give you this full context, then we would have completely avoided the 2015 shooting of the 3 people in Baton Rouge by the Black Nationalist member. We would have completely avoided the 5 police officers in Dallas who were shot by a black nationalist leader. We would have completely avoided a lot of these different things. Sheriff Clark went on Don Lemon. I don't know if you remember that sort of heated exchange to talk about this, but him and Don Lemon went head to head on CNN where Sheriff Clark just came out and said, listen, like, here's what's really going on. Why are you choosing only to cover this and not tell the rest of the people that? You know, when we talk about radicalizing people, and this is something else that I said on Michelle's show today, like they're always talking about like YouTube personalities radicalizing people when it's literally the global mainstream media who are their coverage of certain stories and cherry picking that is leading to a lot of these attacks to occur. I mean, what do you think is more powerful? Some guy in his garage, me on in front of
I think I am more powerful. That actually my podcast is far more powerful than CNN.
Far more powerful. Yeah, exactly. You could be right, actually, because most of the viewers come from like gym TVs and hotel TVs that are closed now, by the way. So, but I mean, it's like, and then you have like ABC News sharing a video of a Kentucky gun range and trying to tell its viewers that it was like warfare in Syria, trying to get the population on the side of or another regime change war that can lead to tens of thousands of deaths. But we're the problem on YouTube. It's just so preposterous. It's not even funny anymore. It's just like, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah. And it's sick. And this narrative is going to be cemented no matter what happens in court. Like most of the American population who hears about this case is automatically going to think Ahmaud Arbery was an innocent jogger riding, you know, running in his neighborhood, even though it wasn't his neighborhood. And these evil white hillbilly racists, like, you know, they hunted him down and they murdered him in cold blood. And he was totally innocent. And he was a great figure who had never committed any crime before. and they're not going to see the police footage from his prior encounters with law enforcement. They're not going to see, they're not going to notice the construction videos. Clearly him looking around and acting suspicious around a site that had been previously reported that burglaries were happening there and that people were, the owner had said that like stuff was being stolen. Even though now that property owner is so worried about the wrath of the Arbery family's attorneys that he's just like, oh, I installed videos just to see my friends who came into my house. Like, oh, it's Arbery. It's my good friend Ahmad. You know, he's coming in to check out my house again. And
get some water.
That's not what he's saying because he's so terrified of this. And especially with now the guy who got charged in the pursuit of videotaping is charged with murder. This guy is definitely going to be more committed to agreeing with the Arbery family's side of the story.
And so he just wanted to get hunted down by the mob.
Yeah, and it's the same.
But actually, he did say, did you see that news report? So there's like this local news station that I follow. And he did say that the neighborhood was, quote, on high alert after certain neighbors had stuff come up missing. This is directly from the homeowner himself. Now, he said that there's this other guy who I forget his name, but he had some sort of Hispanic last name. He was a neighbor. He wasn't white, obviously. You can tell by his name. And unless he was a white Hispanic, but not sure. Anyway, this neighbor said that the next time that you see movement on your camera, please call me because I had stuff stolen out of my truck. You know, this neighbor down the street had some copper, you know, something stolen. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I know that the neighbor had tools stolen out of his truck. And he said, the next time that you see this, let me know. So the next time that he noticed something, some movement on his camera, was the day of the shooting between the McMichaels and Ahmaud Arbery. And he called his neighbor, and his neighbor said, well, I don't know if we should be too concerned with this because what I'm hearing is that there was a shooting, that the McMichaels pursued him, there was a shooting, and it was probably this guy who kept going to your house. This is what this homeowner said. So
yeah, the homeowner was playing ball or was essentially agreeing with the McMichaels prior to this video release. He was saying that like, yeah, there was a lot of, you know, I was having some property stolen from there. There was other people who were reporting this. And now after he's like, oh, I have never seen anything stolen from my property. There was nothing going wrong in our neighborhood. I don't know what these guys were up to. He completely changed his story from, you know, before the video release until after. And it was just all this pressure that they feel. And it's the same that's always going to, you know, the media narrative for Trayvon Martin that he was murdered in cold blood and George Zimmerman got away with murder. Nothing can change that. They're all just going to think about how
Same thing. Yep.
With Trayvon Martin was just a good kid who was walking home. They're not going to watch. They're unfortunately not going to watch the Trayvon hoax by Joel Gilbert on YouTube, which all my listeners should give that a watch as soon as they can if they have not. And they're not. And they're also going to think that Michael Brown was murdered in cold blood, as we saw when, you know, Elizabeth Warren and I believe Kamala Harris both said that he was murdered in 2014, and people are still recognizing his murder. There was a big liberal account that was like saying, like, we remember of Michael Brown that he would have been 24 today. And I was like, Michael Brown like attacked an officer. It was like, may have even tried to kill him. And we're supposed
committed
to like
strong arm robbery.
He committed a strong arm robbery where he against another non-white against
some like Arab or something.
Yeah, it was an Indian. I think it was an Indian store owner.
Right.
Yeah, he like threw him against the wall, walked out, and then began attacking a police officer who simply said this guy matched the description in the store. And sure enough, he did. And this was Darren Wilson. Officer Darren Wilson was just trying to do his job, and he was nearly killed in it. And he was charging at him, and Darren Wilson, you know, put him down with lethal force, as he's taught by the law. But he was murdered in cold blood, even though the department, Obama's Department of Justice, ruled Darren Wilson acted in righteous self-defense. So this is, it doesn't matter what the truth will be. The media narrative will always stick. There's always going to be this like rash of white on black murders that are happening. We still have lynchings. There's all these police officers just killing people left and right. And they're not going to look at the facts. They're not going to look at the actual interracial violence data of who's, you know, who's disproportionately committing it. And it's not white on black. It's more black on white.
Right.
You know, they're never going to admit that because that's just the media narrative. That's what movies tell them.
Right.
That's what they think that our culture's like.
Right.
They think that, you know, blacks somehow have to worry about walking around in a white neighborhood, which, You know, it's much safer to walk down a white neighborhood than it is to walk in, you know,
everyone knows that.
Or East St. Louis, you know.
Yeah, and everyone knows that. Everyone knows that. As a matter of fact, it's much safer to walk in Rio de Janeiro, in the favelas of Rio de Janeiro, than it is in St. Louis.
Yeah, but the real danger is walking in some suburban cul-de-sac where, like, some guy is, like, washing his car. And then it's like, this might be a secret Klansman who's going to pull out his AR-15 and gun me down for walking down his cul-de-sac. And people really believe this. And they're saying this after this shooting. There's so much ridiculous rhetoric of, like, there was some viral tweet by – it was essentially by a nobody, but it went viral about, like, white parents, how are you making your white sons better and not committing all this violence against black kids? And there was all these horrible white liberals like, oh, I'm reading Ta-Nehisi Coates to them. Oh, I took them to Black Panther. I'm trying to make them woke and nice. And they're like, that ain't good enough. And it's like, like,
well, the worst one, and I know you want to go on to Jeff Sessions, but the worst one was, do you remember Angela West?
The name sounds familiar, yeah.
So this guy got into like a struggle with police officers in 2015. One of the police officers' gun went off because the guy was trying to reach for his gun.
Oh, yeah, that was in Louisiana, correct?
No, Boston. Okay, it was in Massachusetts. Okay, yeah. And so his gun went off. Anyway, the guy didn't, he got released, right? Because no big deal, gets released, right? He had long criminal history. You know, typically we see these people get released. Anyway, he goes on to shoot another police officer in the face. Shoots a police officer in the face. Police officer fire back, killing this guy. And Black Lives Matter marches and riots because this guy, Angela West, was killed. The police body camera footage shows everything. And then Black Lives Matter holds a town hall where there's signs outside that say no whites allowed. And the media is playing Angela West, innocent guy, shot by police. You know, this is the narrative, not only in the media, but it's the narrative in academia. It's the narrative in Hollywood. It's the narrative on TV. It's the narrative everywhere. And so you're completely right. I mean, this is leading people to believe this, to not look into it for themselves, because the majority of the population are just completely lazy, fat idiots. And maybe not the majority of the population, but a big portion of the population.
Well, people just don't do their own research.
Right, yeah. Right. They don't have time.
Go ahead.
Right. Well, I was just saying they don't have time to. Right. A lot of people, to be fair, they don't have time to do their own research, right? But I mean, this is what the media hates so much about social media and alternative pundits, is because we're the only ones that can actually flip this narrative upside down like we did for Covington Catholic. Right. Yeah. If there was no social media, that narrative would have carried on and everyone would have hated these high school kids, and they would have never been able to go to college, and, you know, their lives would have been over. So
that is one positive thing about this, is that the main Nick Sandman, who was like at the center of the Covington Catholic controversy, right, is now graduated from high school and he's going off to college, and he looks like a kid who will be, you know, have a bright, successful life.
Yep.
And this is all due to the efforts of independent media. And when I was watching the Trayvon Martin documentary, I was thinking, is like, thank God we now have more independent media. Even though in 2012 this was already starting to develop, it wasn't as big of a thing. There was not as many YouTubers. There was not as many people on Twitter who were able to counter the mainstream media narrative in a way that is very effective. I mean, in 2014, this would have been much more developed, and there was already much more skepticism towards the official media narrative around Michael Brown versus Trayvon Martin. Pretty much everyone was like saying like Trayvon Martin was murdered in cold blood. Even a lot of conservatives, like I even believe Rush Limbaugh was initially believing it. And one of the first people to actually challenge the narrative was, shocker of all, was David French, who wrote this commentary article, I think in summer of 2012.
I do remember that.
It's behind a paywall. I think you can get the archive link, so you can get around it. But it's a pretty good article, and it shows all these conservatives, and it's like chastising them for rushing to conclusion and agreeing with the mainstream media. Now, of course, David French is at the forefront. It's like, oh, this is terrible lynching with Arbery and everything. I mean, due to the Trump effect, that he went from the most right-wing National Review writer to the most like cucked National Review writer, which is a pretty competitive field to be in that. And this happened just because of Trump, but, you know, digression with that is that due to independent media, the development of, you know, people on Twitter doing their own research, like going after it and looking into these cases, now more information can get out there, and not everyone can just like believe whatever CBS News or CNN is saying. And so there is one positive thing is when these cases happen, now independent media is so well developed that we can now get the real story in a much quicker time. We don't have to wait for the justice system. I mean, if we didn't have, as you were saying in Covington Catholic, if we didn't have that, they would have never, they would have been seen as the worst white teenagers ever. These would have been evil alt-right neo-Nazi teenagers that Trump is developing. And it would only come out like a year later that, oh, this wasn't that big of a deal. But it would have been set in people's minds. But because people immediately reacted to it, immediately took that and was like, this has not happened. Here's some other videos that are showing what really happened. Here's another video that shows what that these kids weren't doing anything wrong. Due to the quick reaction to that, now Covington Catholic is a sign of media malpractice rather than a sign of the growing evils of neo-Nazi Trump teen supporters. So, you know, we'll conclude on that note with Ahmaud Arbery. I wanted to
real quickly, there's a guy named Jason Wilson. Are you familiar with The Guardian? He's like,
I think I know.
He's like heavily involved with like Antifa groups, according to reports. Anyway, this guy had a headline that said how conservative media transformed the Covington Catholic students from pariahs to heroes. And he concludes his article by saying that that our original narrative, as of Wednesday, as a result of these well-worn tactics by independent media, liberal media has almost completely backed away from their initial justified take on the Covington Catholic story. When will we ever learn? This is what The Guardian is saying.
They never admit wrongdoing. Right. Even though there were several lawsuits launched against these media outlets and some of them lost, you know, they're never going to admit wrongdoing. They're always going to say conservative pounce on media error. They're like, and they'll always like pat themselves on the back for any correction. They're like, we salute. Like, I remember there was one time whereas ProPublica made a huge mistake on some report on a Trump administration official, and they got the whole story wrong, and the media was congratulating them for like quick response, quick correction. We salute you. Thank you for doing this. And it's like they royally screwed up an article. Like there's nothing to congratulate here, but there is so much. You know, we could talk. There is so many errors and so many wrongdoings. But I would just conclude that. You know, thank God for independent media that now we can get the truth out there. But now moving on to from that positive note onto a more depressive note, we have the unfortunate tale of Jeff Sessions, who, of course, is Trump's former attorney general and was the first senator to endorse Trump. And I believe he was only the third lawmaker, national lawmaker to endorse Trump. There was two congressmen to endorse him before. And this is a big moment for Trump's campaign when he finally got Jeff Sessions, who was a well-respected senator, long-term senator. He was a powerful figure, and he was behind Trump, which everyone was saying that Trump was done. It was a cancer upon conservatism, as Rick Perry, who later went on to serve as Trump's energy secretary. But anyway, Trump delivered the shiv to Jeff Sessions last week. The president kept tweeting out his endorsements for Sessions' opponent, Tommy Tuberville, and attacks on Sessions. At one point, Trump even pinned one of his tweets attacking Sessions. The tweets were insanely petty and a massive disservice to one of his most loyal supporters. He said that Sessions was cowardly, a slime, and should drop out, and pray that Doug Jones loses the race because he's a big government liberal. Trump's anger is entirely over Sessions' recusal from the Russia investigation, which the president believes is the root of all of his problems. Vince, was this Trump's worst moment?
Yeah, it was just, it's really bad, honestly. It's just another example of just terrible, terrible decisions on a personnel level, right? So we constantly see this from Trump. I don't know what it is about hiring and supporting people and promoting people that Trump has just been cursed on. Someone made the joke a while back that maybe, remember those witches that were trying to cast the spell on Trump like not too long ago? Maybe this was the curse, that he's just absolutely atrocious when it comes to personnel decisions. Because honestly, like you said, he was the first senator ever to endorse President Trump when everyone else was afraid to. And then
he was an enthusiastic supporter. You have to remember, even in the general election, most of the Republican Party was not an enthusiastic supporter.
Nope.
Sessions served as a surrogate. He went out there when nobody else would to defend Trump at his worst gaffes and just say, I believe Trump. He's the best candidate for this country. You know, you weren't seeing people that Trump is currying favor with now. Like, Lindsey Graham never even voted for Trump. And Trump goes out and golfs with Lindsey Graham and is like, my buddy Lindsey Graham. Well, Lindsey Graham was saying he's going to be the suicide of the GOP. He's going to be the worst thing to ever happen to the GOP. And now they're best friends, but he's shivving Sessions.
Right. And honestly, it's like, then you look at his opponent. This is what makes it even worse. Like, I would be fine with it if his opponent was like an immigration hawk, or even, you know, more of an immigration hawk than Jeff Sessions, but he's not. I mean, he hired Tommy Tuberville, hired Zuckerberg's consultants that are extremely pro open borders. There's a tweet here that I saw from Ryan Gradusky. Says, quote, so Tommy Tuberville hired Mark Zuckerberg's pro-open borders consultants to teach him about immigration and Never Trumpers to be his top aide. Guess where else his staff came from? And he posts this picture, these article excerpts. And one of them says, along with Eric Iverson of More Information doing polling and John Downs working with Jesmer on media, Tuberville is showing that he is 100% serious about mounting a professional top-notch bid. It goes on, it says, Danny Diaz and John Downs will become advisors to Bush's Right to Rise PAC, an organization that could serve as the precursor to his official bid. They will likely join a campaign organization should he choose to run. So Tuberville's top campaign aide not only tweeted that Trump was a shill for Putin, but Tuberville's would-be chief of staff absolutely despises Trump, Rob Jesmer, and supports Bush's and Obama's 2014 immigration amnesty bill and Bush's amnesty policies, right? So this guy is like an open borders corporatist sort of a guy.
That's MAGA, though. That's MAGA, dude, because guess what? Tuberville, he was a college football coach, man. He's going to get in the game, and he's gonna arrest Obama. Like, they're going to have this. And people, like, literally believe he's, like, the real tough guy in the race. And it's like, Tuberville, like, made, when he coached at Ole Miss, he made Ole Miss ban the Confederate flag from the stadium so as not to give offense to people. And it's like, and this guy's going to take on the Democratic establishment when he told Mississippi college students to not fly the flag of their ancestors that is strongly associated with the school and its culture, and he's going to ban it just to not give offense. And you think this guy is going to take on the swamp? No, he's not going to take on the swamp. Jeff Sessions, and they want to say that Jeff Sessions is a coward. Jeff Sessions was the only one calling out immigration and demanding legal immigration reduction when no one else would do that. He was the main fighter against the 2013 amnesty that the whole Republican Party was like, we need to get behind in order to win Hispanic. He was the chief opponent to it. And if you want to say he's cowardly, then why did he endorse Trump when everyone said that this was the end of his political career?
Doesn't make any sense.
He showed courage. And he showed courage to support Trump. And even his recusal, I don't necessarily agree with it, but in a lot of ways, he had to do this because he's like, if I don't recuse myself, I may get into some legal messy water. And it's happened with a lot of Trump's associates is that they kind of went along with a lot of Trump's shenanigans, and then they ended up with like six figures of legal fees for doing that.
Has Trump pardoned any of these people, by the way?
No, he hasn't pardoned like any of these people.
Right. All these people who got arrested, like this is Sessions even tweeted out. He said, I had to recuse myself by law. Otherwise, you know that they would come after me and arrest me. Which, by the way, have you pardoned any of these people? Have you pardoned, you know, some of these people that are being locked up during this whole thing? Of course, no, you haven't. Have you? It's like, and then you look at what Sessions has done. He's the guy who actually set up the groundwork for the public charge rule and the wait in Mexico policy. These two policies would not have been feasible without Jeff Sessions' work. I mean, if you just look at he single-handedly derailed Bush's amnesty. He fought against cheap labor his entire career. So he's not paid for by sort of the corporate corporations who want this cheap labor. And then if you look at most of the headlines coming out or that were coming out about Jeff Sessions, like this is from Vox. Jeff Sessions gave Trump the immigration crackdown he wanted. Here's from the ACLU, how Jeff Sessions is attacking immigration judges and due process itself. Here's from the Atlantic. Jeff Sessions is quietly transforming the nation's immigration courts. So he is responsible for not only the groundwork of the public charge rule, the groundwork for the wait in Mexico policy, the groundwork for a lot of the funding transfer for the quote wall, but he's also responsible for transforming the immigration courts and the immigration judges. And this is the guy you throw under the bus just because he recused himself. Otherwise he would have gotten arrested. And now you're supporting someone who's pro open borders. This is like a constant with President Trump. You look at Mike Pompeo. Mike Pompeo hired a person named Mary Kissel. She, during the while Trump was getting her, while the election was happening and while Trump and after Trump won, she was constantly tweeting out like this anti-Trump stuff. Trump is going to end the world. Trump is the end of the world. We can't have this in the Republican Party. And we're constantly seeing this with Trump. He keeps hiring people who absolutely despise him. All of these leaks that he's always complaining about is because he keeps hiring people who hate him. It's like, and we keep seeing, and now this is yet another example, but this is probably the worst example of it. And you have all these MAGA people who are like, well, Jeff Sessions is a traitor. No, he's not.
Yeah, he's not and they say he's a traitor for the most pettiest reasons. They're like, well, Michael Caputo now has legal fees. Right. It's like, that's bad, but the immigration, people didn't vote for Trump to defend like Michael Caputo and like Roger Stone and like these people. I mean, yeah, we appreciate their help and like it's terrible what happened to them. But that's not the main concerns. That's not like make America great again. It's not about these personality issues that are involved with people with Trump. It's about, you know, restoring law and order. It's about cracking down on immigration. It's about eliminating these light on crime policies that Obama instituted, which Sessions eliminated. Sessions was like, we're going to bring back law and order. And Trump in his announcement or in his speech at the RNC was talking about, we're going to be the party of law. And of course, Sessions was delivering on that. Sessions was his most effective, one of his most effective people in his cabinet. I mean, Barr has been pretty good, has been a pretty decent replacement.
Surprisingly, which is
surprising. He's been pretty decent. I still don't think he's as good as Sessions because Sessions was much more ideologically and principle committed to those America First policies. But Barr has been pretty good. But at the time when Sessions was in Trump's cabinet, he was the best by far. And he was the only one trying to implement an America First policy. And they care so much about this recusal when it's Trump's own dumb fault that he had the Russian investigation. Jared Kushner, who we'll talk about in just a second, advised him that he should fire James Comey because in the middle, and I believe it was like in March, and it was like not at the time he entered office when it would have been a much better time to fire him. He's like, hey, you should fire James Comey because Democrats will love you because they believe James Comey cost Hillary Clinton the election. And Trump's dumb self was like, okay, I'll fire him. And they were initially like, oh, Democrats will love this. And for like a brief 30 minutes or hour, Democrats were like, you know, good riddance, James Comey. And then they realized, wait a minute. Like, let's weaponize this against Trump because he just fired an FBI director who we believe, and this is impeding an investigation. This is a real crime. And then they were shrieking and louder, and they were just got so angry about this that Trump, in order to quell the unrest, he appointed a special prosecutor. His own office is responsible for that. That's not Sessions' fault. The outrage from the Comey firing, which Comey sucks, like nobody's wanting to defend Comey, but Trump fired him at the absolute worst time on the advice of Jared Kushner, and Steve Bannon and others who were much smarter than Jared Kushner advised him against this because they said this was a terrible idea, that he should wait for a better moment. He fired him. This led to the Russian investigation, and the rest is history. And you have to say that this is not Sessions' fault. Like, it's not Sessions' fault for deciding to do the legally appropriate method. We can argue that maybe he shouldn't recuse himself, but what is done is done. What led to this was Trump firing Comey and then his own dumb decisions. And at the end of the day, he didn't even get impeached over that. He got impeached over something else stupid he did.
And is he, and like, honestly, like, now we have all the information to start, like, to start really cracking down on people. We have all these documents come out. We have all this information that has come out. does it even look like Trump is going to pursue charges against people who are responsible for this entire hoax?
Yeah, absolutely
no,
not.
Of course they're not going to. Like, the whole Q crowd, remember back when Sessions was in, they're like, activate Sessions. Like, the Q post would come up. And now it's time to activate Sessions.
Sessions had control of the mold culture. Even the Q people are like, oh, he's attacking Sessions as a part of, like, his grand plan. Like, Sessions is still in on it. It's like,
oh,
no.
My God,
Trump
no
is
way.
Being really petty and pathetic right now.
They're going back 40 chess. Like, Trump and Sessions really know it. So, like, they're going to team up in the end. And actually, they're just attacking Trump. They're attacking each other on Twitter. It's like, come on, guys, really?
And the unfortunate aspect about the Sessions thing is that the whole MAGA crowd is 100% on Trump's side. And it does show that a lot of this is just a cult of personality, that it's not as much of an interest in his issues. Even though those issues, those people do care about the fundamental issues. Like, Trump can't, like, support, like, a Gang of Eight-style amnesty. He can't just go in and, like, you know, start speaking Spanish or stuff like going full board, like, you know, shit lib or something like that. You know, they do still care about the issues, but they mainly care about the cult of personality. And they're like, Trump is always right. We just love Trump. And the issues are secondary. And this is happening once again with Sessions. I mean, Sessions, unfortunately, doesn't really have the kind of big dynamic personality to take on Trump. I mean, he's a simple man. He's very committed to his principles. He's not necessarily the greatest public speaker. He's, you know, he's just like a diligent lawyer. He's just like an honest lawyer, but he's not, doesn't really have the personality to take on Trump to demonstrate that, like, I'm the real MAGA. He's just somebody who's unfortunately having to get browbeaten by somebody he risked a lot to support. And this is the long term about, like, whatever with the nationalist moment that happens with America, it always follows Trump's whims and what he's wanting. And, or what he cares about. And there's not really a good nationalist alternative. And everything in pushing the GOP in a more nationalist direction is entirely because of Trump. But Trump is not supporting necessarily the people who are 100% ideologically committed to an America First agenda. He is fortunately not endorsing the Chris Kobach's opponent. I believe his name is Roger Marshall in Kansas. Even though the NRSC and Mitch McConnell and all of them are pressuring him to endorse Roger Marshall because he sees that Chris Kobach has been loyal and he doesn't want to do, you know, Chris Kobach dirty. But at the same time, he's not really supporting Chris Kobach. Chris Kobach was an early supporter of his, and he's always been committed to his agenda, and he helped out his administration. And he's just been convinced by the establishment that he shouldn't support him. And he's not, of course, he's attacking Sessions. He's not showing any support for Steve King or any of these other candidates who are 100% principally committed. He's only showing support for these candidates who, on the surface level, they seem like they're taking on a nationalist populist tone. Even Tommy Tuberville, you know, sounds pretty good on immigration, but you can't trust him about this because he's not ideologically committed to it. He's not Jeff Sessions. I mean, if he's in the Senate and as long as the Trump moment lasts, he'll probably be decent on the issues, but he's not going to be a champion of these issues, and we desperately need a champion in the Senate. And for whatever reason, Trump won't support that. You know, his agenda is not getting across the finish line, isn't making serious progress because he doesn't have these serious champions in Congress. He has a lot of sycophants. A lot of people will be like, Trump is the greatest president ever. We love Trump. But they're not seriously committed to that agenda that Trump ran and won on in 2016.
Yeah, I mean, if he really was seriously committed, we would have seen Jeff Sessions raised up. We would have seen even Stephen Miller with all of his gaffes, you know, here and there, sort of given the entire reins of the immigration.
Miller is given a lot of power with immigration. There's like a difference.
Yeah, he's like butting heads with Kushner all the time. And like Kushner's like winning most of these battles, apparently. From what I've read,
it's like Miller stays like singularly focused on immigration issues, and he's won most of the stuff on immigration. Like there, like the Trump administration would be a lot worse on Miller. The problem with Miller is that Miller is not building up a network within the White House,
right?
A powerful network of serious nationalists because he wants to be the only person in the room who's like a serious immigration hawk. It can only be him, and he's not developing an outside institutional network. And a lot of these people, like, you know, Centers for Immigration Studies and Coulter and a lot of other people, are upset with Miller because Miller is just, he's kind of, if you ever play basketball, he's a ball hog. He's just wanting to win one for the team. He's not playing with the team. He's just wanting to be the only star, and he can be the only one scoring baskets. And that's why, and that's a part why Trump's agenda has not succeeded so far. I mean, Miller's done a lot of good. He's stopped a lot of things, and he has advanced a few agenda items, like, you know, Trump's cracking down on refugee intake and making a lot of the, you know, the public charge rule, implementing that last year. That is Miller's work, but he could do a lot more, and it could be a lot more effective in getting legislation through. But Miller's a ball hog. He wants to be the only star, and anyone who may threaten that, he tries to kick out. Like, he got rid of Cisna, who was USCIS chair, who's really good. He felt threatened by Cuccinelli. He felt threatened by Kobach. He kneecapped Kobach's potential to become immigration czar in the Trump administration because he saw him as like, oh, this guy's going to steal my limelight. I can't have that. So there are problems with Miller, but he has ensured that immigration stays in his domain, and he's netted more victories than
he has. Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. I think that he has netted more victories than defeats, but the fact that Kushner is even, like, you sent me this article. I don't know if you want to go over this. I know we don't have much time left, but it says scoop inside.
We got plenty of time left. My producer is just in my ear, and he said we have plenty of time left. You know, I'm in my luxurious studio right now.
I'm in my hot ass garage in Southern California, where it's like 80 something degrees outside, and I have no air conditioning in here.
It's fine. But yeah, the article you're referring to is that Axios had an article yesterday. This will be airing on Tuesday, of course, but it had an article over the weekend saying that Jared Kushner is trying to take control of the entire GOP platform that's going to be issued at the Republican National Convention and have final say on it. And there's not a too specific details of what he wants. The only things that are really that are specific is that he wants any possible allusion or reference to support for gay conversion therapy to be wiped out of the platform, that it has to be pro-LGBT, and it's got to have African-American outreach as one of the central planks of it. Because in the article, it's saying that the word freedom doesn't appeal to blacks for whatever reason, and it might be backed up by poll numbers. But he's saying that, like, when you're talking about school choice, they should just stick to school choice instead of adding any words of freedom in it. And it is like a disturbing sign, and I'll let you talk a little bit more about this, of what could happen with Kushner controlling the platform at the RNC.
Yeah, I mean, we hear the joke all the time, right? President Kushner, and I mean, I would say largely it's pretty true. This part of this Axios article says, quote, two sources said that they recalled Kushner making a more sweeping point that they should rethink using the word, quote, freedom altogether in the GOP platform because polling showed that it doesn't appeal to African Americans. But another source familiar with the December 19th meeting pushed back adamantly against this. I honestly believe the first two sources on this because, you know, Jared Kushner is one of the major leaders of the whole criminal reform, whatever.
Criminal justice reform.
Criminal justice reform, First Step Act, which, by the way, led to several criminals being released who went on to go and commit murder and rape.
They're not Tom criminals. They're Trump voters now. They may be TPUSA ambassadors soon enough. We'll see.
Who knows? But yeah, there was a Tom Cotton amendment. He tried to put an amendment to where it would alert women when their rapists were released early. And the GOP and the Democrats pushed back and said, well, you know what? Actually, Tom, you're wrong, because it's going to be safer without your amendment, because women don't really want to know when their rapists are released early or released from prison. You know, not like recidivism just doesn't happen, especially when it's specific attackers and specific victims. So this is Jared Kushner. He is, I would say he's left, he's a liberal, right? I would say he's a liberal. Ivanka Trump is a liberal. I mean, this is why it's so cringe when we see them retweets or quote tweets.
Wait, but Ivanka took the red pill. What are you talking about?
I know.
Did
you see that with the quote tweet of Elon Musk?
Taken. Yeah, we talked about this. Yeah, we talked about this in last week's episode of it. But
oh, did you?
It's
okay,
still, like, I'm still recovering from the insanity of that tweet.
It's so bad. It's so bad. But the thing about the freedom and African Americans. It's interesting to me reading this because when we look at the polling on gun rights, we look at the polling on freedom of speech. This is true. He's right on this. Actually, he's not right that we shouldn't be pushing freedom or changing the platform of the GOP, but he's right that freedom does not appeal to African Americans. If we look at the polling on gun rights, 70% of Black Americans say that it's more important to control gun ownership than it is to protect gun rights, when only a minority of whites say this. If we look at the polling on free speech, 75% of Black Americans say that hate speech is violence, when only a small minority of whites say this. Also, if we look at the polling on criminalization of, quote, hate speech, over 60% of African Americans say that we should criminalize hate speech, when only a very tiny percentage of white Americans say this. So it is true that freedom does not appeal to African Americans, but that doesn't mean that we should be trying to appeal to a demographic and an electorate, an electoral group, a tiny portion of our electorate, when we can be trying to appeal to a larger portion of the electorate and probably get more votes from them, because statistics show that Black Americans have never even been over, I think, what is it, 13% for the Republican Party in the entire history of America? It's like,
well, Black voters used to go overwhelmingly for Republicans, but it's probably in the modern era.
If we go back all the way to
Nixon or Reagan, that would be accurate. I mean, they have not. I mean, it started under Roosevelt, under FDR, and then it continued into the 60s. I mean, in the 60s, they really solidified themselves.
Well, because they couldn't vote until here's the data that I'm seeing right now. It's since the early or late 60s, early 70s, it's been about the same. They've been like a monolith.
And that makes sense. They did flee. I mean, they totally became, you know, on the Democratic plantation by the 60s. so that's probably accurate, that since about the time of Nixon that they voted this way. And I'm not even quite sure why this is like serving as such a central focus of the campaign. And they went all over this weekend. They were all over the Biden's comment about, like, if you ain't voting for me, you ain't Black. And they're like, how dare he say this to Black people? But I mean, like, we all know that Biden is going to win over 90% of the Black vote. I mean, the only thing they can hope with Biden is that they depress the Black vote. Is that they ensure that they don't come out for him. Because, I mean, they probably aren't that enthusiastic about voting for an old white guy. Yeah, he may be Obama's former vice president, but at the same time, he's like two sentences away from calling them boy and telling them to grab his golf clubs or something. You know, you're going to vote for me. That's like, that's like the Biden pitch to Blacks. And they definitely had to cover up for his comments about, like, you ain't Black, which would have just ended anybody else's campaign. But they're just like, well, he's the woman who wrote the 1619 or curated the 1619 project, Nicole Hannah Jones, who, as I love to point out, she looks exactly like the clown from the It movie series. She was tweeting about how, like, there's a difference between being politically Black and being racially Black. And there was, like, Black people like, hey, can you please explain this? And she's like, if I have to explain this, you already don't know, and I'm not doing this. And then they, of course, so there's, like, people like this who are defending Biden's comments by, like, saying, like, oh, he's, like, telling you need to be politically Black. You just can't be racially Black. And I'm just, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But they're going to run cover for Biden no matter what. I mean, Biden could say the N-word, and the media would be like, oh, he was reciting rap lyrics. This is showing a new kind of candidate. He's reaching out to millennials by saying the N-word. He was just quoting, like, some Jay-Z lyrics. Like, they would find any excuse to defend it, because they're stuck with Biden, and they know they can be brazenly open about covering for him. And they know that no, like, journalists that they have to worry about outside of, like, they don't worry about conservative media or Fox News will call them out for this.
Yeah, I think looking at the 2016 primary Democratic presidential primaries for Hillary Clinton and the 2020 Democratic presidential primaries, and it seems like Joe Biden has more of the black vote lockdown than Hillary Clinton does, as far as like the primary turnout is concerned. And whereas Bernie Sanders in both primaries had more of the Hispanic vote, basically every other minority. So I'm not sure. I mean, I just don't see the logic in outreach to this particular portion of our electorate. I mean, if they can get 1% or 2%, I mean, that's quite a big of people, but I would say, why not reach out to the larger portions of the demographic of the electorate? I just don't understand. And then like giving up most of the party platform to outreach to this particular portion of our electorate that's likely not going to show an increase, rather probably more of a decrease for Trump. I just don't understand where they're.
I'm in the same boat. I mean, the only explanation is that they think that this will win over college educated white women, which they're doing very poorly in based on the last elections. And this, I mean, that demographic makes more sense to appeal to, even though, as I love to point out on Twitter, they're dominated by awfuls, fluent white female liberals, that they're these types that are almost our main threat to our country, as we're seeing with people like Gretchen Whitmer and others, that they will almost never vote for the GOP. I mean, in some ways, you think that black outreach might work. But they do think that there's these suburban women on the fence that if they show a nicer image of the GOP, it's like, oh, we're doing all these great things for blacks and African Americans, and we're not racist. We're doing the First Step Act, and we're letting out these hardworking convicts who are looking to turn their lives around. And they're like, oh, I guess Trump isn't so bad. So that's the only real explanation to it, is to soothe the consciousness of these suburban white voters who are a little like leery of Trump because they think he's like, oh, he's too racist or blah, blah, blah. They think that there's like serious problems with him, and they think that this will be an effective way to outreach him. But it's just so embarrassing, and it's pathetic how they're doing it. And really, the key to victory is winning back these suburban voters and having a massively high turnout in their rural white constituents who love Trump, love his agenda, and they don't have to. And all they want is just this agenda in place. The best way to get them out is to say, "I've built the wall. I'm cracking down on sanctuary cities. I'm restoring law and order." And Trump, you know, by attacking Jeff Sessions, isn't necessarily doing that. So we'll have to see what happens with this election. Hopefully Jared Kushner doesn't make Trump too bad. But, you know, oh my God. My producer's in my ear. He said we're totally out of time today. Believe that?
Yes.
My producer, so you know, I need to talk with him. He's just always on my case about going over. But anyway, Vince, this has been an incredible discussion. We definitely need to have you back on. I think we, before the show, talked about a subject we can have you on before.
Right.
I'm not going to leak it to my listeners. They'll have to tune in
So. Yeah, but someone else will leak it.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. I'll have to trust my producer to not leak it. Anyway, Vince, how can people find you and support you? I know you keep having new Twitter accounts. Like, I tried to DM you on Saturday, and it said account suspended.
I keep getting my account suspended, but I keep coming back. And, you know, I'm getting all the followers I had back, so it's all good. I've been suspended multiple times. Just go to theredelephants.com. That's probably the best place to find me, or the Red Elephants on YouTube.
Okay, thank you. And thanks for coming on, man. Definitely have to have you back.
Cool, man. Appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. And take care. Make sure to like and subscribe to Highly Respected on YouTube. And also, if you want to support Highly Respected, I am on Patreon for the time being. So go to patreon.com/highly respected. And anyway, until next time, stay respected.